Well, thank you, Stephen, for inviting me to speak with you here this morning, and thank all of you for coming out on this morning. This book came out a year ago, and a year ago this month, and it was the result of really an idea that I had, or what occurred to me, a need where I believe the fundamental cause of the climate crisis is industrialized humans' disconnection from the planet. And I decided I would try to write a book to try to bring people to see in writing, to see these places and hopefully feel them, where the climate crisis is affecting every square inch of the planet now, but places where it is the most obvious and egregious. And I went out into the field in places like the Amazon and the Great Barrier Reef and glaciers in Alaska and glaciers in Glacier National Park and national forests with USGS scientists to see what's happening to all of those different places as a result of the climate crisis, and tried to do my best to write about it in as articulate and personal and emotional way as I could, to try to really bring the situation home to people. Because even here at a conference like this, where most people are acutely aware of the climate crisis, here we are in this room with false light and pumped in air, and it's easy, therefore, to feel disconnected from what's happening out there in the broader world. And especially right now, we can see the news about what's happening in Australia and see really upsetting footage of what's happening to wildlife there, as well as humans. But even that can still feel kind of far away or over there. And I just want to talk to you today about this in a way that I hope brings it a little bit closer. As Stephen just said, here we are at a health conference, and it's been duly noted that the climate crisis is and will continue to be increasingly so the single biggest threat to human health ever. It affects everything, all of our food, all of our water, the places we live, how we're going to travel, how we're going to do everything from this moment on. It's going to become increasingly affected by it. Being at a health conference, I spoke at a nurses' conference up in Vancouver not too long ago, and I looked up the definition of the verb nurse, and part of it said to give medical and other attention to. And so at a health conference where we're trying to pay particular attention to our bodies and to how they're affected by whatever your primary concern is, it seems like paying attention to this crisis and to how it affects us is paramount. I included a quote in my book from a Buddhist monk, Thich Nhat Hanh, and he reminded us of the value of just in being present with what's happening to the planet. He said, quote, "When your beloved is suffering, you need to recognize her suffering, anxiety, and worries. And just by doing that, you already offer some relief." And I think all of us have experienced that whenever we've been sick, and having just a friend or a loved one either sit with us or just acknowledge our pain and our suffering, it helps. It lightens the load a little bit. And I believe that that's possible even to the greater planet right now. I want to read a little bit from an interaction I had with another scientist there, a long-term colleague of Dr. Lovejoy's. And she's a Brazilian scientist, and I like to tell this joke when I talk about the Amazon. Of all the scientists, and there were a whole bunch of them that I interviewed for this book, she definitely wins the blue ribbon for having the best name. Her name's Dr. Rita Mosqueda. And she's a biologist and researcher with the largest research institute in the Amazon. And I met with her in Manaus and would like to read a little bit about that interaction. There's a forest fragment in the middle of Manaus, which is a very large city of well over a million people. And we were, she took several of us on a little nature tour through the forest fragment and was very excited talking about different things, different animals, different insects, different plants. And occasionally one of us would ask her, well, you know, what can you tell us about this plant, for example? And she'd say like, oh, well, I really don't know that much about it, but, and she'd go on to list like the name, the genus, you know, the species, just everything. She was literally a walking encyclopedia and extremely passionate about what she did and loved her work. And again, like Lovejoy was because she cared about the rainforest so much and had literally devoted her entire life to studying it. And this is pre-Bolsonaro in Brazil, so things were already very, very bad. But of course now, you know, keep in mind while I share more of this information that this is before the wildfires in the Amazon last summer and before Bolsonaro came into power. So Mesquita sees the world questioning conservation now and jeopardizing all the victories that have been achieved in setting aside land up until now. I work hard for conservation, she told me, but I lose sleep over wondering if I'm wasting my life. Am I wasting my life? Is this a lost cause? I keep doing it because it's the only thing I know to do. She says that she does not believe she and her colleagues are doing their jobs with the urgency needed. What we are not telling the general public what is really going on, she said. Having co-edited a book with Lovejoy and authored many peer-reviewed scientific papers, Mesquita is a force to be reckoned with, but she personally feels inadequate when looking at the bigger picture. It is clear to her that we are nowhere near where we need to be. I have zero pride in all my papers because we are preaching to the converted, she says. What I want to do is talk to the outside world. I want to be able to just talk to people and tell them what is actually happening. We need to educate people about what is really going on with climate disruption. Like so many of the experts I'd spoken with for my book, Mesquita believes the root cause of climate disruption is humanity's lack of connection to the planet. Even here in Manaus, kids don't understand that they live in the Amazon, she told me. So there is no connection at all with anything, and that is the problem. There is sadness in her voice when she tells me this. I made a personal decision to not have kids because I don't have a future to offer them. I don't think we are going to win this battle. I think we are really done. The tropical rainforests around the planet are already so degraded that, in the Amazon specifically, that instead of absorbing emissions, they are now releasing more carbon. It is now releasing more carbon annually than all the traffic in the United States. In 2010, the Amazon drought alone released as much CO2 as the total annual emissions of Russia and China combined. We're losing 1.5 acres of rainforest every second. At some point in the not-so-distant future, the Amazon will regularly emit more carbon than it absorbs, yet another critical tipping point for Earth. And I'd like to close out talking about the Amazon by reading part of one of my interactions with Dr. Lovejoy that is very pertinent for this conference. There are reasons other than moral concerns for protecting the Amazon, including our own self-interest. Quote, we go to the doctor in the pharmacy and we have no clue where our drugs came from, Lovejoy told me. More than that is from nature than we realize. He mentions a poison found in the Amazon that led to the production of the pharmaceutical captopril, which in turn became one of the first ACE inhibitors and is now used by hundreds of millions of people to control their blood pressure and heart conditions. Captopril widens blood vessels, making it easier for the heart to pump blood through them. Most of the people taking it have no idea that this drug responsible for their health is from the Amazon. He mentions another example, a vine found by indigenous people that when they threw it in a lake, all the fish came up to the surface gasping for air, which made their fishing much easier. The name of the substance that causes this is curare. It is used today as a muscle relaxant during major abdominal surgeries. His point is that if we continue to destroy the Amazon at our current pace, we may never know how it could help save millions or possibly billions of human lives in the future. Lovejoy believes that this is one of the least appreciated aspects of biodiversity. Quote, "The Amazon is a gigantic library of the life sciences, which is continually acquiring new volumes," he says. "We are discovering new species of birds all the time. And wrapped up in all of that is incredible adaptation capacity. It's important to remember each species represents a set of solutions to a set of biological problems, and any one of those can turn out to revolutionize how we understand biological science." Lovejoy pauses and gazes admiringly at the jungle surrounding the camp where we sit, then turns back to me. "We are so stuck on ourselves, we don't think we need any of it," he says. "We think we are some godlike thing." I want to just share some broad brushstrokes now of what's happened on the planet just since this book came out in January a year ago. I gathered together some information for the epilogue that I wrote for when this book is released in paperback in a few months from now. And this is far from a definitive or far from a fully inclusive list of major events or scientific studies that have come out just in the last year, but it gives you, this will give you an idea of how quickly things are progressing on the climate front. Just 1 week after my book was published, a team of glaciologists from UC Irvine in California and Utrecht University showed that over the course of 4 decades, the total mass loss of ice from Antarctica had accelerated at a pace 6 times faster than it had during just the 1980s. By July of 2019, scientists were trying to determine if glacial melting there would become irreversible. Think about that. Irreversible melting in Antarctica. They're questioning if that's already a possibility, if it's already in motion. Later in 2019, researchers in Greenland told the BBC they were, quote, "astounded by the rate of acceleration in the melting and expressed fear for coastal cities in the future." One of the scientists said, quote, "So we're losing Greenland. It's really a question of how fast," and said Greenland is already facing a melting, quote, "death sentence. The loss of the Greenland ice sheet alone will raise global sea levels 20 feet. Another study warned that if current warming trends continue, and there is no reason to think that they will do anything other than continue to accelerate, the mighty Himalayas could lose most of their glaciers by 2100 as they warm up by 8 degrees Fahrenheit. This will bring radical disruptions of food and water supplies for upwards of 1.5 billion people, in addition to a refugee crisis of staggering proportions. As winter gave way to spring across the Northern Hemisphere, it emerged that 2018 was the 4th warmest year ever recorded, with the only warmer years being 2015, 2016, and 2017. This year is on track. Granted, I wrote this in December, as in 1 month ago. 2019 is on track to become the next 4th warmest year on record. That is another way of saying that the last 5 years are the hottest 5 years since record keeping began. So it didn't tie for the 4th warmest year on record. It became the 2nd warmest year on record. And that means the last 6 years are the 6 hottest years ever recorded. At the same time, the UK's Met Office announced that we are living in what will likely become the warmest decade ever recorded. And then since I wrote that a month ago, the 2010 decade was absolutely the warmest decade ever recorded. The global food supply is already under severe threat from an ongoing and catastrophic loss of biodiversity, just as Lovejoy was warning. Around the world, the library of life that has evolved over billions of years, our biodiversity, is being destroyed, poisoned, polluted, invaded, fragmented, plundered, drained, and burned at a rate not seen in human history. Ireland's president, Michael Higgins, said at a biodiversity conference in Dublin, quote, "If we were coal miners, we'd be up to our waists in dead canaries," end quote. Climate disruption-fueled extreme weather patterns are also adding to the risk of a global food crisis, as research revealed how multiple bread baskets could fail at the same time. An analysis published in the scientific journal Biological Conservation reports that plummeting insect numbers globally could lead to the collapse of nature, quite literally. Quote, "Our work reveals dramatic rates of decline that may lead to the extinction of 40% of the world's insect species over the next few decades," end quote, reads the abstract of the study. It warns that insects could vanish within a century, and the researchers remind us that insects are, quote, "essential for the proper functioning of all ecosystems, and that the current trends are disrupting, to varying degree, the invaluable pollination, natural pest control, food resources, nutrient recycling, and decomposition services that many insects provide." To put it simply, when the insects are gone, so will be humans. And right now, we are on a trajectory to lose most of the insects on Earth within 100 years. The Amazon rainforest, as I mentioned, burned last summer at a record pace, seeing an 80% increase in wildfires compared to the same period the previous year. Smoke from the burning forest darkened the sky over Sao Paulo, more than 1,700 miles from the fires, which were so large, their smoke also covered parts of Bolivia, Peru, and Paraguay. Dr. Lovejoy, whom I mentioned, warned in an editorial in the journal Science Advances while the fires were burning, quote, "We believe that negative synergies between deforestation, climate change, and widespread use of fire indicate a tipping point for the Amazon system to flip to non-forest ecosystems in eastern, southern, and central Amazonia at 20-25% deforestation," end quote. The World Wildlife Fund, which Lovejoy used to head, estimates that 17% of the Amazon has been lost in the last 5 decades. And that statistic came before last summer's fires. The fires of last summer have brought us that much closer to the tipping point he warned us of. In fact, we could have already passed it last summer. Meanwhile, things went from bad to worse for the Great Barrier Reef. Not only is the reef subjected to ongoing bleaching events happening at a pace far beyond the natural rate at which they occur, but climate crisis-fueled rain events caused the reef to experience smothering of its coral when floodwaters drained onto it, bringing soil runoff with them. Some of the scientists referred to this as the nail in the coffin for the existence of the largest coral reef on the planet, which then received another nail from the Australian government shortly after that, when it decided to give the green light to dumping 1 million tons of sludge across the reef. Less than 6 weeks after that, a study was published showing that the reef had suffered an 89% collapse in new coral after its bleaching events of 2016 and 17. This means that as the reef dies, it is unable to come back to life as the waters in which it live continues to warm, sediment-filled rainfall runoff covers it, and assaults from the Australian government continue. Meanwhile, in December, a study showing how the planet's oceans are rapidly deoxygenating, with some areas in the tropics having already lost 40 to 50% of their oxygen. To make matters worse, a landmark report showed that no matter how much emissions are cut, extreme sea level events that used to occur once per century will happen every single year by 2050. A previous study had already warned that unless dramatic emission cuts were made and coastal defenses against sea level rise dramatically strengthened, coastal lands that currently house 300 million people will flood at least once every year by 2050. An Oxfam report published last month showed that already one person every 2 seconds is being forced from their homes due to the climate crisis. My concerns about what was happening in the Arctic regarding the increased release of methane have been proven out, as earlier spring rains this past year there have been thawing the permafrost at an accelerated rate, hence releasing more methane than ever. In fact, permafrost across the Canadian Arctic is now thawing out 70 years faster than had been earlier estimated, according to Dr. Vladimir Romanovsky, who I'd also interviewed for my book. Another historic event occurred in 2019, this one in the form of the country of Iceland holding a funeral for the first glacier the country lost to the climate crisis. A plaque left on the location of the vanished glacier offers a letter to the future with the message, "This monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and what needs to be done. Only you know if we did it," end quote. Humans are now currently injecting CO2 into the atmosphere at a rate 9 to 10 times higher than that during the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, PETM, global warming event 56 million years ago, which acidified the oceans and drove large numbers of marine species to extinction. Quote, "The fact that we could reach warming equivalent to the PETM very quickly within the next few hundred years is terrifying," Larissa DeSantis, a paleontologist with Vanderbilt University, said of the study, while geophysicist Gabriel Brown with the University of Utah observed, "We don't have much in the way of geologic examples to draw from in understanding how the world responds to that kind of perturbation." 3 months after that study was published, for the first time in human history, Earth's atmospheric concentration of CO2 reached 415 parts per million. Less than 2 weeks after that, the International Energy Agency announced that global carbon emissions set a record in 2018, increasing nearly 2% over the previous year to set a record of 33.1 billion tons. By November, the UN's World Meteorological Organization reported that the concentration of climate-heating greenhouse gases had hit another all-time high and announced there was, quote, "no sign of a slowdown, let alone a decline," end quote. Also, last year, the Trump administration began the formal withdrawal of the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement, and New York State's claim that ExxonMobil had misled investors for years about the risks of climate disruption was rejected in court. All of this in just 2019 alone, and this is far from a complete catalog of the unraveling of the biosphere. So I was forced, that kind of information is what this book kept bringing up over and over and over from all these different places on the planet. And by the time I got to the conclusion, I literally had no idea how to end the book. It was impossible to try to, you know, end on a positive note. And it felt a lot more honest. And I personally had to go inside and find new meaning and new reason to get out of bed in the morning. I was struggling with depression and much the same way that so many climate scientists are, that there have been several very good articles come out about that. And this is why increasing numbers of colleges like University of Washington and Seattle up nearby where I live are starting to teach climate grief classes and have curricula, increasing curricula addressing that. But so for the conclusion of my book, I basically had to start waxing philosophical and finding new ways of being on the planet. And so I did my best to share that with readers, and I want to share a little bit of that with you today. And one person that I came across that has helped me a lot in processing this information as well as figuring out how to be during this time was Stephen Jenkinson. He's a Canadian author and storyteller and has worked in the palliative care industry for decades, during which he was confronted with the Western medical system's denial of death and refusal to really do endings, which of course, you know, is an integral part of life. So he was giving a talk at Simon Fraser University in Canada a little ways back. And he was talking about the climate crisis, and I just want to share a little bit of what he said. The question is not, are we going to fail? The question is, how? The question is, what shall be the manner of our inability to care for what was entrusted to us? The question is, our manner of failing. Jenkinson, who now makes his living by teaching about grief and the acceptance of death as an integral part of living, has spoken eloquently about grief and climate disruption. And so when he talks about our future to care for what was entrusted to us, he is also saying that the time to change our ways is long past. Quote, grief requires us to know the time that we're in. The great enemy of grief is hope. Hope is the four-letter word for people who are willing to know things for what they are. Our time requires us to be hope-free, to burn through the false choice of being hopeful and hopeless. They are two sides of the same con job. Grief is required to proceed. So we're at a point now on the planet when we really understand the gravity of the climate crisis and other converging crises, our domestic political crisis, for example, the deforestation crisis, the pollution of our own food supplies crisis, the use of pesticides, all of these things coming together. We really are literally in an existential crisis. And so the feasibility of humans not making it through this is getting talked about in an increasing way in different circles. It's becoming possible, and a lot of people believe likely. And so it really puts us right up against these questions that Stephen Jenkinson has talked about and writes about, and other people that I include in the conclusion of my book. And it really gets us down to a point of, where do we find meaning in this, and kind of where do we go from here, knowing how overwhelming all of this information is, and how do we deal with it personally. And that's why I chose the subtitle of my book of Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning. It's how do we find meaning? I've had to really dig deep in order to try to find meaning in this.